Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Finance Minister Grant Robertson is this morning rejecting a criticism that the Reserve Bank, asking the Reserve Bank to focus more on house prices could mean unemployment will go up. The Finance Minister wrote to the Reserve Bank Governor Adrian Orr, asking him to take heed of the impact cheap lending has on house prices in setting monetary policy. The bank responded by saying it had already takes house prices into consideration, along with those other measures of employment and inflation. Grant Robertson told me earlier that the cooling the housing market and addressing inequalities in the economy must be a joint effort, but he reiterated that the bank's decisions are their own to make.
We're asking the Reserve Bank to consider what it can do to support the government in the overall objective of sustained moderation. The final decision about what they do still remains theirs under our independent monetary
policy.
Well,
to quote the BNZ, they say the announcements most definitely make it more difficult for the Reserve Bank to ease monetary policy further than already announced. And markets certainly interpreted it that way. Interest rate markets saw spikes. So you have effectively done that.
Well, as I say, what we've done is do what is covered for under the Reserve Bank Act, which is for me to seek the advice of the Reserve Bank Governor on a potential change to the monetary policy remit so that they have to give some consideration to house prices as part of the work that they do when they're setting monetary policy. It is really important to me still that it is an operationally independent decision, but it is the government's job to be clear with the Reserve Bank about what our objectives and our goals are. What we were talking about yesterday wasn't putting all of this onto the Reserve Bank. It's actually a shared responsibility. And we also talked yesterday about the work that the government's doing to identify what else we can do to achieve a sustained moderation.
Absolutely, and I will get to that in a second, but I just want to deal with these issues around the Reserve Bank first. Some economists argue that, in fact, what you're doing here will mean that the Reserve Bank has to give, as you say, you want it to give more consideration to housing. That means it will give has to give less consideration to unemployment, and unemployment will go up as a result.
I absolutely reject that, and I was very clear yesterday that we are not altering the primary objectives of the Reserve Bank as laid out in Section 8 of the Reserve Bank Act. That is the job, to ensure that we have price stability, in other words, keeping inflation stable, and to work towards maximum sustainable employment. Nothing changes about that. These are the what we're discussing here are the matters that the Reserve Bank has to give consideration to when they are setting monetary policy and when they are working towards achieving those goals. It is important, you know, to note that they already have a number of matters they have to give consideration to around the exchange rate, around the level of output in the economy, the stability of the financial system. These are matters that they consider. We are suggesting one option here is to consider house prices in that context, but it does not change the focus on achieving.
Okay, but they already, as you will have seen in the letter that came back to you from Adrian Orr, they argue that they already do consider issues around housing and financial stability, and that raises the issue of whether, in fact, and some have argued again, some economists, that this is just political theatre from a government that is to blame and feeling the pressure.
Well, no, and obviously, you know, I've seen that letter from the Reserve Bank, and I'm sure it's encouraging to all of us that those matters are considered. At one level, you could say that makes it relatively easy to adopt the proposal that was in the letter yesterday, but actually the letter goes a bit further than that and invites the discussion, which I think is an important one, between the Reserve Bank and the government about what other tools are in the Reserve Bank's toolbox, both within monetary and financial policy, that could be used to help achieve the goals the government has, which include sustained moderation in house prices. So it does come back to the fact that everybody has a part to play here, and one of the essences of monetary policy is balance. It's balancing different considerations such as inflation, such as levels of employment, and considering all of the impacts of monetary policy on the economy.
The Reserve Bank is looking at the LVRs, bringing them back, which would put some restrictions on high-risk lending. Will you consider giving the Reserve Bank the ability, if it needs it, to go further and do debt-to-income ratios?
Well, again, the system provides for the Reserve Bank to propose new monetary macroprudential tools to the government. If they choose to propose that to us, we'll consider it. as I say, the point of the letter is to say to the Reserve Bank, what else do you think you need in your toolbox? What other ideas do you have for the way you operate monetary and financial policy? And so that proposal was previously put in front of the government before ours, and it wasn't supported. But we will consider any request that comes forward, given that we have the ones who've written the letter asking.
I just want to be clear on this. So you will consider debt-to-income ratios, which would mean there'll be a limit on how much people could borrow. That would clearly hurt first home buyers, but you will consider that policy?
What I'm saying is it is the right of the Reserve Bank to propose that to us. By saying that I would consider it doesn't imply that we would necessarily agree to it, merely that if we're asking them to provide us with options for what they can do, we can hardly reject the fact that they might provide that. But what happens then is that we provide our input on that. Ultimately, again, remains the decision of the Reserve Bank to whether they would go through with that. So I'm not saying we're agreeing to it. What I'm saying to you, Corin, is that actually we are asking the Reserve Bank to have a look at what they can do, just as we are saying we're taking another look at what the government can do to help control house prices.
The housing crisis is an issue brought on by government policies over the last 20 or 30 years. Isn't this just about you shifting the blame to the Reserve Bank because you've cut off one of your key avenues, which is to deal with a wealth tax or a capital gains tax?
No, and in fact, the reason we made the announcement the way we did yesterday was to highlight the fact that there are several things going on here. Yes, we have long-run issues in the New Zealand housing market, including a substantial lack of building of affordable housing over many decades. We combine that with the effect of very low interest rates across the world and COVID-19. The fact that this was an unexpected thing that house prices rose like this, almost every bank economist expected them to go down as a result of COVID-19, and they went up. And therefore, it's on all of us to make sure that we see what we can do. So in the announcement yesterday, we said we are looking at both what more we can do in the supply of the housing and also what we can do to manage demand, and asking the Reserve Bank to think about that. So no, we all have a responsibility here, and there's plenty of policy space outside of the things that we've ruled out in terms of what we can do to support more affordable housing.
Bright line tests would appear to be one of those, are currently set at 5 years. What sort of time frame is in the ballpark to extend that? Could you push that out to 10 years, 15 years?
So what we've asked the Treasury to do is give us advice around what our options are and further demand-side measures. And yes, you're right, we've pushed the bright line test out to 5 years, which means that if you do flip a property that isn't your family home within that five-year period, then you will be paying tax on it. We want to take a look at how that policy is actually working now and then consider whether or not it would be something that could be extended. But clearly the Treasury have been asked by us to look at the existing measures and any possible new measures outside those that we've ruled out. The bright line test is one we've got in place, so let's have a look at how it's going and consider what else we might do with it.
Would you rule out going to 10 years, and at what point does it become a capital gains tax anyway? At 20 years?
Yeah. Look, I'm not going to do the ruling in, ruling out game today. What we've asked the Treasury to do is come back to us in rapid time with their thoughts on the existing measures that we have. And obviously we've done things like the ring fencing around rental losses, the ban on overseas buyers into the existing residential housing market. We want to check on how they're going and look at any proposals the Treasury might bring to us around other initiatives as well. So we'll take our time to do that, but we recognise it's important that we get on with the job.
At the end of the day, whilst you've got improving books, you've got a better than expected economy, there is still an incredible difficult outlook because of COVID-19. Hasn't the Reserve Bank, by allowing house prices to run, simply been rescuing the New Zealand economy? And if it's being asked to pull back from that strategy, doesn't the government then have to spend more?
As I said yesterday, I give credit to the Reserve Bank for being decisive in the early days of COVID, making sure that they joined with the government in our strategy of building cash flow and confidence in the business community. But as I said, you know, even just 3 or 4 months ago, virtually every economist in New Zealand was expecting house prices to go down. The New Zealand economy, relatively speaking, is doing very well at the moment. There are challenging times ahead, but we are in a situation now where, you know, off the back of a recession, we have a house price boom. That's pretty unusual. That means that we've all got to stop and think about the strategies that we're undertaking here. But I give credit to the Reserve Bank for the work that they've done. We've just all got to take a moment now to look at the rapid escalation in house prices and see what we can all do to get a period of sustained moderation.
Finance Minister Grant Robertson there. Now, the Reserve Bank Governor will be holding a press conference later today for the Financial Stability Report. That's the other aspect of his job, and we will be speaking to the Reserve Bank Governor, Adrian Orr, tomorrow morning.
The handover from the presidency of Donald Trump to Joe Biden has begun, 3 weeks after the presidential election. Mr. Trump took to Twitter to say that while he acknowledged the handover is happening, he still believes he was the victim of what he continues to call a rigged election. Harvard Law School's Lawrence Tribe, a member of Al Gore's legal team in 2000, says the jig is up.
We now know for sure, as we knew before, but now it's without the slightest doubt that Joe Biden is the president-elect. He will be the president of the United States, and it's very clear that there are no options left.
The sign-off by the General Services Administration now means funds are available to Mr. Biden to begin preparations to assume office. The president-elect has begun to appoint key cabinet positions, including former Secretary of State John Kerry for a top climate change role. He's also nominated Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence and Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary, the first woman to hold these roles. The nominations have the support of former President Barack Obama.
There's been some damage done that is going to take some time to dig ourselves out of. But there's no doubt that Joe's got the right people to do it. And I have every confidence they'll be able to do it. It just may not happen instantaneously.
With us now for more on this is The Atlantic's Isaac Dovere. Hi there, Isaac. Thank you for talking to us on RNZ this morning. So it's been 3 weeks. How crucial has that been, that time lost to the Biden campaign for the transition?
Well, thanks for having me. What we see here is that the Biden campaign knew that if he won, that he would probably not be getting a lot of participation from Donald Trump and his team. And it's really not a surprise to see Donald Trump be less than gracious in defeat. If you go back to any time that he's lost anything, he says he didn't really lose and he complains about it. So the Biden team was preparing for that eventuality and was moving forward over these weeks, knowing that they would maybe get some cooperation and maybe not. As of yesterday, that cooperation, this formal process begins, which allows the agencies to start talking to folks who are involved with Biden's team. And that process is important. The federal government in America is enormous and complicated, and there is a lot that needs to be done beyond just saying this person's going to now be the Secretary of State versus that person, but that there are a lot of other people down through the agencies and each one of these agencies and each one of these offices that will be getting replaced, and with the hopes that it will be somewhat seamless, whereas, of course, it's not going to be completely seamless.
And these key cabinet positions that are coming out, what are the signals given by the people that Joe Biden is choosing?
There is a very clear message that Biden is saying here. He's not picking really well-known names. He's picking people who are very experienced, and that's a big difference. People whom he knows well, for the most part, people whom he has worked with either in his time as vice president or since. That is the way that he is going about building the government so far. We'll see what more comes, but some of the most important roles have already now been filled between the Treasury Secretary and the Secretary of State.
Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you talking to us this morning. Isaac Dovere there from The Atlantic.
Qualifications Authority figures show teenagers ended October with about 300,000 fewer NCEA results in the bag than at the same time last year. The figures also show big variations in the way The lockdown affected NCEA results in different parts of the country. Schools in Tasman, for example, had reported 40% fewer excellence results than normal, while in Gisborne the figure was just 2%. John Gerritsen is our education correspondent. He's been crunching the numbers. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Okay, how far off the pace are students this year then?
Okay, well, nationally, if you look at the positive results, so the achieves, the merits, the excellences, they've got 17% fewer positive results reported to NZQA by October the 28th. And if you break those down, it's 18% fewer achieved and merit results and 15% fewer excellence results. But look on the positive side, there's 22% fewer not achieved results. And what's interesting here is that the proportion, the balance of those categories, not achieved, achieved, merit, excellence, pretty much the same as last year. So the results are mirroring a normal pattern of achievement. It's just fewer of them.
So some resilience there. And what about different regions?
Yeah, well, Auckland's had two lockdowns that closed classrooms and forced kids to learn at home. Now, their achieved merit and excellence results, you look at those in totality, they're down 20%. But some other regions, which didn't have two lockdowns, are also showing some big variations. Tasman, those positive results are 28% down on the same time last year, including that 40% drop in excellence results. But then look, somewhere like Otago, they've just got 9% fewer achieved merit and excellence results. And as mentioned in Gisborne, the schools there have reported only 2% fewer excellence results.
Any idea why the regional variance?
Well, what we're looking at here, when I've talked to principals, is probably schools reporting results a bit later and a bit of variation in those patterns. You know, certainly when you say, okay, well, look, are we going to see a big drop in the number of kids passing this year? Principals are going, oh, actually, we're thinking it's probably going to be okay. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is more results are being reported now since October 28th. Also, there's learning recognition credits, those extra credits young people can get. Now, in Auckland, you can get up to 20% of the credits you need for an NCEA qualification from those credits, and 13% in the rest of the country. So that's going to make a big difference. And of course, many students normally get a lot more NCEA credits in a year than they actually need. So if you've got a bit less of that, they're still going to pass. And in fact, I've talked to some principals, admittedly not in areas like Auckland where they've had a big impact, who've said we could have a bumper year. We could have more kids than ever getting the excellences, getting the credits.
Fascinating. John Gerritsen, thank you very much for that, our education correspondent.
Now, you were hearing earlier about Finance Minister Grant Robertson's public query to the Reserve Bank asking how it might do more to stabilise house prices. This has the support of the National Party. In fact, Shadow Treasurer Andrew Bailey says National came up with the idea first, having this week expressed concern at the Reserve Bank's funding for lending programme. Mr Bailey said the lending should be targeted at productive investment rather than piling more pressure on an overheated housing market. With us now, National leader Judith Collins. Kia ora.
Oh, good morning, Susie.
Now, the Andrew Bailey taking the credit or trying to take the credit here, is that fair?
Absolutely. In fact, Andrew Bailey was the one first speaking about it. And on Monday this week, Jacinda Ardern was saying that would be Muldoonist. A few days later, suddenly it's the government thinks it's a good idea. So, look, I think give credit where it's due. We always try to give credit where it's due, and Andrew Bailey has actually shown the government what to do, and they've taken it.
What actual material difference, though, is this going to make?
Well, it can make quite a difference. So, particularly when we consider that the Reserve Bank has pumped an awful lot of money, around an extra $8 billion, into the existing housing market through the banks, the trading banks. Mm. But actually, we've now got less than $6 billion less going into the productive sector, such as building new homes, but also into businesses.
But the timeline here, it's a letter was sent yesterday. The Reserve Bank is going to respond in December. Then, of course, we hit Christmas, New Year, summer. Everyone goes on holiday. Nothing's going to happen realistically before February. And the Reserve Bank was going to act in March anyway. They said that themselves a couple of weeks back. So actually, what difference does this make?
Well, let's just wait and see. I think what it does do is it tends to indicate the direction of travel for the bank. So if you're looking at the LVRs, the loan-to-value ratio. That is something where banks are already taking that up, with some saying now they want a 30% deposit rather than a 20 or a 10%. So it already shows that banks are sitting there reading the tea leaves and they're working out what to do. But of course,
but doesn't that stuff just make it even harder for first home buyers to get in if suddenly it's not a 20%, it's a 30% deposit?
Well, you're correct. And that is why the big focus has to be on getting new houses built. And that's why we've been constantly talking about the Resource Management Act and its reform that's urgently needed.
Yes.
And I would say to the government, reach out across the aisle, let's make this lasting and bipartisan.
So you would be keen on bipartisan stuff there. In terms of other aspects that you would be supportive of, would you like to see debt-to-income ratios being brought in?
Well, these are things that the Reserve Bank and the government need to think about, and it's certainly one of the tools, but none of that is actually going to create new houses. That's what we really need. We have a shortage.
No, but it's about a suite of things. I'm not saying don't build any more houses. All I'm saying is other things that we've got in the toolbox that could come in immediately, that's one of them, isn't it? So would you support that?
Well, if that's considered to be the right thing. So, like you say, it's not one thing only, but certainly the start has to be in the government saying to the Reserve Bank, you need to consider how existing houses are going through the roof with no new houses or very few new houses being built. That is not going to build new houses. What we've got to do is get those houses built.
Should the Bright Line test be extended longer than 5 years, and if so, to what?
Well, it shouldn't be. That's just absolutely has made no difference at all, the taking it from 2 years to 5 years. In fact, it hasn't helped whatsoever to get people into houses. I think it's important. The big
But wouldn't it stop investors being able to flip houses?
It actually also stops investors bothering to buy houses to put tenants in. But actually, it hasn't made a scrap of difference. If you think 5 years is...
So should we just get rid of it then? Is the Bright Line test a waste of time and we should just get rid of it?
Well, I think it was something... Well, we're very clear that 2 years is certainly enough. But we do believe absolutely the focus has to be on getting new houses built. And that's always been the problem. And that problem is around planning and the Resource Management Act.
Let's talk a little bit about the National Party AGM that you had at the weekend there. Some reflections, I guess, on some of the headlines that came out of that. Were you supportive of the comments made by Peter Goodfellow, where he labelled Jacinda Ardern a televangelist and said she was tyrannical?
Well, he didn't quite say that, did he? But he did. Well, he didn't quite say that.
What did he say?
So what? No, I'm not going to go repeating.
But are you supportive of that? Those were words that were used in his speech. So do you support those words?
I thought that wasn't quite the way I would put it, and it wasn't what I said. So I'm not going to answer for Peter's speech. He's perfectly capable of doing it himself.
Well, if he would come on the radio, he could do, but you are the leader of the party, and you are on the radio, so I'm asking you if you support him.
Good try. I think it's really important that he said exactly what he felt had happened.
So is it Trumpian?
My focus was on moving ahead. No, I don't think we go around labelling people like that. I think that's really not where
Why
we want
isn't
to be
it Trumpian?
Well, for a start, I think it's really important that people have free speech. The National Party, we believe in free speech. We also believe that the president can give what he says in his speech. That is his opinion. It's not my opinion. My opinion is very much that the National Party has to look at where we went wrong and also how to correct that. I'm not worrying about the past. I'm worrying about, not even worrying about anything really. I'm focused on the future.
On the future, Peter Goodfellow obviously seemed to be the future of the party with his re-election. You are going to be taking a long, hard look at the National Party. Judy Kirk, one of the people who is doing that, she did that else well back in 2002 for that review. So she's part of the reason, isn't she, of where the National Party is now. So why is she the person who's going to be looking at where to take it from here?
No, she's not at all. She's got nothing to do with that. She's a highly capable person. We'd also say we've got Jamie Beaton, a chap who's young man in his 20s.
So is she not part of the review?
Well, she is part of the review, but she's certainly not part of the problem.
No, I wasn't saying that. But she was part of the review in 2002.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yes, and she's now reviewing it again.
Yeah. Well, she and four other people. Mm. And the review panel is chaired by someone who, Mark Darrow, who hasn't been part of any review. None of the other people have been part of a review that I'm aware of, the National Party. The fact is you don't always want to have a group of people who have experience as well as people who are coming in with entirely different ideas and looking at everything fresh. Mm. That's why we have five people, not one person doing it.
Is this going to take into account, I guess, the last 3 years of National, in which case is the culture review under Simon Bridges going to be looked at as part of this review?
I think it's definitely going to be taking the last 3 years of National, and it's going to look at all the things that, you know, certainly the caucus performance, and it will also look at the party performance. So obviously we will all be...
And that culture review, or does that not exist?
Well, I'm not sure about, as I've never seen it myself, so I always think these things need to be looked at. I'm sure they'll look at everything.
Would you go away and have a look at it?
Well, if I had it, I would. But thank you for reminding me. I'm sure they're all to come into the review.
You're welcome. Just a quick note on whether you'll make your submission or indeed the whole report public when it comes out.
Well, that'll be a decision for the board, Susie, and the normal course of events. An executive summary is produced, the findings are produced, but I doubt very much that we will be making everybody's individual submissions public. And certainly I think there are some things that I might wish to say which I'd like to keep to the review rather than to put it on your radio program.
You'd be most welcome to if you wanted to, though. Judith Collins, thank you very much.
Scientists are waiting for a sample from the Air New Zealand crew member who tested positive for COVID-19 after a flight to China. The crew are due back in New Zealand this morning and will be isolated and retested. The crew member tested negative before leaving on the trip but tested positive once the plane had arrived in Shanghai. Dr. Gemma Geegan, a virologist at Otago University, says she and other researchers are eager to get a sample to help identify the strain of the virus involved. She joins us now. Morena, what do we know about this case? What's your thinking on this at the moment in terms of where this was picked up?
Yeah, well, as you said, it's actually really hard to understand how someone got a virus when there's no known physical contact with someone who had an infection. So the only way we can determine perhaps where and when this person became infected is to... look at the genome sequence and compare it to the genome sequences that we have already for the cases that we've had in New Zealand. And that's really the only way that you can determine, where this person got infected.
So once you've got that a sample, you should be able to work out whether or not it was a New Zealand infection, bearing in mind it's not foolproof, is it? You might not have a match at all still.
That's right, yeah. So it's very likely, given that this person is a cabin crew member, this infection might have been contacted from, you know, at different parts of the world. So, and it's also very likely that if it was a global case that, from international case that this person got infected from, then the genome sequence might not exist. So there are challenges. And also, it could be that this is a historic infection as well, so it might not be the case that there's enough virus in the sample to actually sequence a genome. So there are challenges, yes, but going forward, I think what we can do is try to sequence the genome, and if so, then we can compare it to the genomes that we have already from the New Zealand cases.
This might sound like a silly question, but are there standards of testing different? So we've seen this a few times where people have turned up overseas and suddenly tested positive, but they've been negative in New Zealand. I mean, is the testing different?
Well, the testing can be different. There's different methods used. But also, it's important to realise that a negative test doesn't necessarily mean that someone is not infectious or doesn't have the virus, sorry. So... you know, a negative test means that there's not enough virus present in the person to detect at that time. And And again, we've seen this quite a lot of times before. You know, often people will get pre-departure tests before they even come to New Zealand, and then become and then show a positive test during their stay in managed quarantine and isolation. So a negative test doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have the virus, right? So that's another thing to keep in mind. Mm.
And your research has shown that it is very much possible to catch this virus on planes.
Yeah, that's right. So me and my colleagues at ESR and also in the Ministry of Health, we looked at a bunch of people that arrived on the same flight into New Zealand, and they didn't know each other, and their only contact was during the flight. But during their stay in quarantine, they tested positive for coronavirus, and we looked at their seating, the seating plan of the plane, and it turns out that they were all seated within a few rows of each other. So, yeah, it was very strong evidence that these cases that were genomically linked, was actually the transmission occurred during the flight.
So this has implications then for those arguing that there should be pre-flight testing, that that's not going to be the 100% guarantee you want.
That's right. So the majority of these passengers were tested negative before their flight, you know, a few days before their flight, which is often the requirement for airlines. However, we've shown that that's not foolproof. And I think going forward, you know, it's really important to, if we want to stay on this elimination strategy, to really, basically treat everyone that's arriving from outside of New Zealand as a potentially infectious and implement the quarantine period.
Just looking ahead, and it was interesting to see Qantas yesterday already signalling that they would look to have people vaccinated before they took a flight. That's happened before in the past, hasn't it, where people were required to have proof of vaccinations for various things. Is this the way you see it going?
Yeah, it's definitely something that has been used in the past, and perhaps that's the way forward. Obviously, we need to know that the vaccine is going to be effective and safe, and although they're looking extremely promising, some more research might have to be done to determine that.
Dr. Gemma Geegan, thank you very much for your time, virologist at Otago University.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.